Welcome to Motivated to Lead podcast, helping you become a better leader. I'm your host, Mark Klingsheim. Hi, everyone. Mark Klingsheim with SEMA Partners. Glad you could join us again for our podcast this week. Each week, we interview a leader, and if you're new to our podcast, please go back and listen to some of the earlier episodes. This week, we're happy to have with us Randy Haken. Randy is a serial entrepreneur, an educator, angel investor, a philanthropist, and he has an undergraduate from Brown University and an MBA from Harvard. He started his career in the Bay Area at Apple and was the fifth executive at Yahoo as their VP of sales and marketing. He went on to work with a number of startups and had a fund to invest in early stage IT companies, and has been a mentor and a coach to many executives in the Bay Area. He's taught at the UC Berkeley Haas School of Business, as well as Cambridge University Judge School of Business, and started the Gratitude Network, which trains social entrepreneurs from all around the world. And he has some great thoughts he's going to share with us today, and looking forward to our conversation with Randy. Randy, can you give us, first off, just give us a little bit of your story, your background, and your career history?
Sure, Mark. I grew up on the East Coast. I'm fortunate to have gone to Brown undergrad. I did that in organizational behavior management, which has kind of come full circle back to a lot of the leadership work that I do today now. Then after getting my MBA at Harvard, I came out to the West Coast to work in the tech world. And started with Apple, was there for 5 years in different sales and marketing roles, left to take a role at Paramount. That led me to a startup team, which was to become Yahoo. And I joined that team as number five on the team and had a chance to really see one of the early internet startups from the inside out. Got to participate in all the board meetings, and I was the VP of sales and marketing there. And then started working with a lot of startups after Yahoo's IPO, and I left Yahoo and began to coach other startups and invest in them, and had the opportunity to turn that work into a venture fund. So the original venture fund was called Interactive Minds, and a couple years later in 1997, we renamed it Outlook Ventures, and my partner Carl Nichols and I ran that for 15 years in San Francisco. Made about 40 early internet, early IT investments during that time and had a blast. And then basically left the venture world to try my fortune as a coach and as a professor. So I taught at UC Berkeley at the Haas Business School for about 7 years, part-time. I enjoyed that. And while I was doing that, I also was coaching many CEOs of startups. I was doing a lot of angel investing, and more recently started a nonprofit called the Gratitude Network. So in the last 6 years, we've been coaching social entrepreneurs all over the world.
Great. Well, you're representing the 49ers today. This is after the Super Bowl. Your color's on, so.
You can't get the red out. Gold is left, but the red is still there. The hurt is still there.
Well, there's next year, so yeah, they had a great season. Yeah. Well, tell me a little bit, you know, one of the questions that I was thinking about is you came to Silicon Valley, to the Bay Area, kind of when all the action was taking place. And talk a little bit about what that was like, and just kind of the atmosphere that you experienced as you moved there from the East Coast.
Well, you know, just like many places around the world, because of technology, the Silicon Valley has dramatically changed. The first thing that comes to mind is the cost and the traffic out here.
But right.
I think really it's the diversity that's just astounding. That, you know, now that I think about it, when I first came out, you had financial services in San Francisco, and then you had a couple of tech firms that were really growing nicely, like Apple, which I joined, Intel, Fairchild had been one of the early ones there. But what I've seen over the last 30 years now is this area has diversified, whether it's because of Berkeley and Stanford and SFU, or maybe it's because of the workforce that migrated here from all over the world. But now you have biotech, you've got health and life science innovation with UCSF, for example, being one of the top research institutes in that area in the world. And you just see a real diversity across many different areas of technology, I guess because technology has pervaded our lives. So that's the main thing that I've seen since coming here.
So one of the questions that I ask every leader that comes on is, if you were knowing what you know now, if you're able to go back and talk to a 22-year-old Randy, what advice would you give him?
I say plastics, go in the plastics. I think the advice I'd give a 22-year-old, which I took a little of this playbook myself, but I say you start with a reputable brand. If you're going into a career, start with a brand that is something you believe in. I was fortunate to go to Apple. I love the Macintosh. And the reason I loved it, I was very creative in my youth. And that was the machine that the creative people were using. So if I could then back a product that I loved and I went into sales and marketing, then you can believe in, you know, what you're working on. And I think that's where the enthusiasm and the love for the work begins. People recognize that, and then they want to do bigger and better things, you know, to help you along your career. So I think that was certainly a key piece of advice I would give a 22-year-old. The other quick advice I would say is, if you're 22, enjoy life while you can, because it only gets more complicated. So those would be the two pieces of advice.
Yeah, and I'm sure you wish you would have invested more in Apple at 22, right?
Well, no, you know, when you went to Apple, you got stock. And the real question is, did you hang on to your stock?
Right, yeah, absolutely.
I have friends who have been at Apple now really the entire 30 years. They never left. One of them went from being an intern to being the vice president of products for Apple today. So it's kind of fun to watch people that stayed that long and really were part of the ride.
Sure. So on the flip side of that question, is there any advice that you received when you were in your 20s that you wish you would have ignored, or you did ignore?
Oh, advice to ignore. Advice I got coming out of school is, you should go into consulting. That would be, you know, you're smart. You get a variety of projects. Or maybe investment banking, that would be a good place. But what I learned when I really got out there is, if you have an entrepreneurial spirit, you could start certainly with consulting. There are some great leaders today that have come out of Bain and McKinsey and some of these other amazing firms, but there's no substitute for street smarts. And I'm telling you, sitting in the original board meetings for Yahoo and listening to Mike Moritz from Sequoia, and a couple of the earlier board members, just phenomenal education. Actually trying to figure out the business model for Yahoo, which essentially was banner advertising when there was none, and working with Jerry Yang to work on the details of what would become a huge business model, a multi-billion dollar business model. That was fun. And there's nothing that substitutes for that experience. That's what I would say.
So you saw a lot of, and you've seen it as a VC, as an investor in companies, as well as in the companies that you were part of that initial team at Yahoo and others. What advice would you give somebody that maybe is a new leader that's building out their first executive team? What are some things that you would advise them?
Yeah, well, right now I work with a lot of CEOs who are first-time CEOs, not just historically as in venture capital, but today in my own practice, I'm coaching a lot of these folks. And one of the key things I think is just understanding what, in order to get your vision done, to reach your vision, who has to be on that ride? Who's got to be in your stable? And then go find A players to map up to the things that have to get accomplished in order to get you to the vision. I see a lot of founders that try to do too much on their own. It'd be better to figure out what you need to raise in order to get great people to work with you, because everyone's got their own expertise. Typically, a leader is not going to have all the expertise that they need in order to launch. They may be able to handle the sales initially, right, and the leadership, but probably not the product and the sales and the marketing and the operations and the admin. So I think getting great people, you know, you see the greatest leaders are the ones that people follow from one job to the next. You can see it historically. You look at Eric Schmidt at Google, for example, just people following him throughout his career from Novell to Google, et cetera. So I think that's one of the key rules.
So somebody coming into a position where they there may be a new leader, or they're now the CEO of the company, and they have a new boss called the board that they're going to need to work with, and the investors that are part of that. What are some things that you would advise somebody going in, maybe the first time that they've worked with a board? What do you advise new CEOs?
I always suggest that they get to know people on a personal level, because you don't want to have a relationship where you're just seeing them once every month or once every few months. They're going to come in and hit you with a bunch of questions. It's always good to reach out and really get to know each of those board members personally. So you build a rapport, build a relationship with them. The other is just being genuine and transparent, because, you know, most of the board members are there to help. A couple of them are there to mind their money. That's a given. But they genuinely want to see you succeed, whether it's because they want to make a profit or they want to see the company be successful. So I've seen a number of CEOs who will be really cautious about how they play their monthly meeting and what they're going to talk with their investors or their board about and what they're not. And I think it's a better policy to just come up with the things that are really going to shape the business, that are the key factors that are going to contribute to the success of the business. Track those like a dashboard, and let people know if you're having a hard time on one of the elements on the dashboard. You know, they should know if it's a red versus a green or a yellow that month. Let them help you.
That's good. That's good advice. What books do you give out, or you always are telling others about that they should be reading, and maybe new things or things that you've read in the past that you should be on every leader's bookshelf, sure, but read?
You know, I do. It really depends on the area, but I'm a big, you know, going back just foundationally from leadership, I'm a big believer in Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. That kind of thinking, I just loved, you know, as I was developing my leadership style, or even Dale Carnegie's books. And these things are timeless. You know, sure, you can look at Peter Drucker, but that's complicated business management stuff. You know, he comes up with all kinds of theories. But Dale Carnegie and Napoleon Hill just seem to hit some really basic facts. Another favorite of mine is Tony Robbins, Awaken the Giant Within, or any of his early books. Tony, again, master of psychology. I think a good leader understands psychology. More on the management, or let's say growing a business, I love Vern Harnish has a series of books, and he has an entire coaching practice globally, which the latest book is called Scaling Up. And I find that any company that's gotten just past its startup stage loves that book, because it puts a process in place that helps you to be a better leader and helps organize your team effort, you know, for any given year that you're targeting a goal. So I love that Scaling Up book as well.
Great. So what are some favorite quotes that you have from some of the things you've read?
I pulled up a couple, you know, I'm going to just read. I do, every year I do my goals. I like to do them so that New Year's Day comes and doggone it, I've got the goal set. And here are four quotes that I have I try to remember and, you know, place at the top of my goals, even before my values. So I do my quotes, then I have my values, and then I think about my roles and I do my goals from all that. But here's four quotes. To whom much is given, much is expected. That's Luke 12, verse 48. That's a favorite New Testament reading. Here's one from Abraham Lincoln that I love. The best way to predict the future is to create it. And, you know, with all the different companies I've been blessed to be a part of that were kind of creating new business models or new products, that absolutely is true. A partner that started the Gratitude Network with me named Guru Singh, he's a yogi and he teaches in Los Angeles. I'll never forget, he said to me, to be in the present moment, to be in the present, you have to forgive your past and faith your future. Mm. And then lastly, a great Zig Ziglar quote, the negative thinker sees a difficulty in every opportunity. A positive thinker sees an opportunity in every difficulty. Mm. And I always tell my team, let's look at this situation, which looks like it's a nuisance. Let's turn this into a positive and something that we can create an opportunity from.
Yeah, good stuff. So there are times that we all feel like we're a little bit off as far as in our focus and need to refocus. And I'm sure this is part of your refocus and looking at your values and your goals. How important is that? Do you do that on a daily basis? What are some things that you do to refocus?
Well, I am into yoga. So for all those that have not tried yoga or you haven't gotten into you know, any regularity with it, one of the great things about it is it not only prevents physical stress. For me, it's lower back pain. After a year of yoga, that went away and it hasn't come back for 8 years. And it used to be perennial for me. You know, I'd lift something on a weekend and boom, my back was out. I haven't had any back issues since. But what I love about yoga is when it's done right in, an hour and a half session, it goes through different phases. So you're not only stretching your body, which is good for you, and actually working on different organs within your body. For example, some of the yoga poses are, you know, focused on the spleen or focused on the kidneys and things like that. So it improves body function, I believe. But the meditative element of it, which typically comes at the end, however, you can practice it throughout if you're really, you know, good at it, also is terrific. So to me, it's like a, you know, three or four things all put into one nice practice.
Okay. So tell me a little bit about the story behind the Gratitude Network. Just tell me about kind of what led up to it and caused you to want to do something like that.
Yeah, as I was preparing to turn 50, I was trying to challenge myself with something that would make it a memorable 50th year. And this is about nine years ago now that this happened. I came up with the idea of what I call Gratitude 365. And the idea was that for each day of my 50th birthday, I would post on social media an image and some little paragraph or phrase with the image that indicates what it was and why I was grateful for it. So for 365 days, I posted something, and a lot of my friends started to follow me. And it really is amazing that, you know, you get 100 days into this and first panic strikes because you go, oh no, what am I going to write today? Right. But then when you think about it, once you get on a roll, I started having a list. The list was so long of things that I could choose from that when I'd get to the next day, I could just go through the list and pick something. And you start really, it's like wearing rose colored glasses of the right shade. Sure. You can start seeing everything as something you're looking for gratitude in every aspect of life. And it was during that year that I thought about the network of friends and colleagues that I've been fortunate to have over the years. And I decided, want to create something called the Gratitude Network, where I could encourage others to be grateful as well. And that's how the Gratitude Network concept was initially born.
Tell the listeners that maybe haven't heard of your organization, but what is it all about, and what is kind of the vision for what you're doing?
Sure. Well, Gratitude Network, which we started about 6 years ago, is essentially a leadership development organization that spans the globe. And our focus is finding incredible social entrepreneurs around the world who are specifically working with children or education, because that's our focus right now. And then giving them the tools and coaching and support that they need to take their organization to the next level. And by doing that, the goal for our team has been, over the last 5 years, has been to impact 50 million children on the back end of that. And we're well on our way toward that. We're in our coming into our fourth year of that 5-year challenge that I put forth to the team. And we're over, cumulatively, the entrepreneurs we've worked with are touching the lives of more than 30 million children.
Wow, that's great.
So that's what that's about.
Tell about the process as far as for selecting who is a part of the group that you're mentoring.
Yeah, when we, 5 years ago, when we first began our focus on education and children, that year, I think we selected four winners. We call them gratitude winners. But as this evolved now, 5 years later, we this year for 2020 chose 30. So the applications come from all over the world. We basically have partnerships with a number of other social innovators who have feet on the ground around the world and have good reach. And they put the word out each year when our application process is open. Last year, we received 1,300 applicants from around the world, and we chose 30 from those 1,300. So it's a very selective process, but the people we end up working with are the most passionate, vision-oriented change makers that you can imagine. And that excites the coaches that we end up matching them to, because the coaches who are highly skilled executive coaches from all over the country. And in fact, we have a few that are outside the country. Now we have 32 coaches that we match. And those coaches have a career of coaching, but in many cases, they've never encountered this kind of a passionate social entrepreneur who wants to really change the plight of underserved children.
Yeah, it's very cool. So
it's really amazing watching when we match the coaches up to the fellows, the sparks start to fly, and then they get to work together for a year as part of our program.
Tell a little bit about you're doing something entrepreneurial with a wine business that is impacting your nonprofit. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. The year that I started Gratitude Network, I also, because of my interest in wine and food, my wife and I started something called Entrepreneur Wines. And it's a brand. There is no physical location. There is no physical winery. However, the year or two after we started, we were introduced to a phenomenal winemaker. I think, in my mind, he's one of the top 10 in Napa right now. So Kirk Benge, who joined us a couple of years into the project, has been producing with us for almost 10 years now, a Chardonnay, a Pinot Noir, and a Cabernet. And all of that is from Sonoma or Napa vineyards. Kirk, who grew up in Oakville, which is sort of ground central for Napa, he knows all the landowners in Napa and Sonoma, so he's been able to get us into really exclusive vineyards. And then we produce only a few hundred cases a year, so it's very, very small, limited production, and only sold to club members who have joined over the years. Now, all of the profits, and initially 25% of the top line, go to the Gratitude Network. So the winery has been 100% philanthropic from day one. mostly because a friend said, well, you're doing two projects here. You're doing the Gratitude Network and you're doing a winery. How are you going to bring those two together? And it occurred to me that my wife and I were not out to make money doing our winery. We were out to create relationships and draw. So it's been a perfect draw. I guess you could call it the social lubricant, you know, for getting other couples to recognize what they're grateful for and to connect them to the Gratitude Network. So the two have really worked very well together.
Yeah, very cool. So you're in an area where technology is definitely prevalent. Any technology that you use on a regular basis that has made you more productive or your life better?
Wow. there are so many. I mean, I think all of us, if I look at the iPhone today and I'm just amazed at all the productivity tools literally in your hands, which I would expect someday will be probably not even in our hands, will be on our bodies or in our bodies in some way with embedded chips and the ability to actually visually and audibly hear, you know, through your body. I've worked with a number of companies that seems to be, you know, they're innovating in that area of wearables and audibles. But I'd say the technology that has impacted me the most is simply the ability to keep notes in the cloud. Something simple like Evernote, I think, has been really very, very helpful. For example, I just pulled my goals up to share with you.
Sure.
I went back quickly 5 years and really easy to index and find notes. The smallest note that I take, I can throw into Evernote. You know, if I'm working on a big project, I can put that in Evernote, but it's always there and it's always in the cloud. So that's been a productivity tool that I really have enjoyed as it's progressed over the years.
Great. So outside of work, you've told us a little bit of what you do to recharge, but are there any other things that you enjoy doing?
Oh, I haven't even started to tell you what I recharge. The first thing is I have three beautiful young women that my wife and I have raised, my three girls, and they are, two of them are married and one is getting married this summer. So I have two grandchildren already and a third on the way. Wow. And they're so much fun. So that's definitely one passion. The second is I love to sing, and I have been singing here in the Bay Area for many years. Initially with two groups that were in the all men's choir type of thing, and one of which went competed with 600 plus choruses around the world and placed number three amongst wow. 600 around the world. So that was just a crazy fun experience. That was about 8 years ago in Nashville that we placed third. But more recently, I've been singing in a group called Chorus Eclectic, which is here in the Pleasanton, Danville area. And it's mixed men and women, and just really a blessing to be a part of that. So those are my two main passions. There's a third passion that's being pulled up by the grandchildren. It turns out when I went through Brown University, I put myself through college partially through funds that I raised as a puppeteer.
Uh-huh.
So I have been doing puppetry for many years, but you know, kind of set it aside when mostly because it wasn't too cool for meeting women. but now it's cool with grandchildren. So
sure.
I will be resurrecting the puppeteer in me. The inner puppeteer will be coming out shortly, and I'm working on my first puppet stage for my 2.5-year-old granddaughter. First puppet stage I've done in 35 or 40 years.
Well, fun. I maybe you'll have to videotape. I've got grandsons, so they're all five and under. We've got five of them, so yeah.
Wow,
you can come and entertain them. So,
yeah, what fun.
What parting advice would you give a leader, a new leader, or somebody that's maybe part way through their career?
You know, one of the big pieces of leadership advice I've learned is when you surround yourself with peers, you know, we used to call it mentorship. It's expanded now. Something that I've been very involved in the last 3 years is called Vistage. And Vistage is all over the world. They've been around 55 years. I'm a Vistage chair. I chair a group of 16 CEOs here in the Bay Area. We meet monthly. That allows them the power of the group. And I think I'm a real strong believer in tapping peers and not reinventing the wheel, even with simple leadership things that you would think, it's a problem I have, nobody else has. And sure enough, everybody else, you know, by sharing your challenges and your opportunities with other peers, other leaders, I just think it's a great way to expand yourself as a leader and also to just be a better decision maker.
It's good. Well, if somebody wanted to learn more about some of the things that you're working on and the Gratitude Network, how would they find that information?
I made it easy for everyone. You go to mylastname.net, HAYKIN.net. And I'll, as a bonus, I will tell you, I not only have all my personal interests, all my work-related things on Haken.net, but if you look up in the top right menu, you'll see a section on philosophy. And in that, I have posed 6 questions that I would love, I would challenge anyone watching this video to go to Haken.net, HAYKIN.net, go up to the top right menu, choose philosophy, and fill out your answers to my philosophical questions about life, some of which are quite amusing.
Well, good. I'll encourage everybody to do that. And Randy, it's been a lot of fun and definitely have enjoyed our conversation. And I know your thoughts today are going to be helpful to those that are listening.
Thanks, Mark. I think it's great that you help share the word like this with people and allow us to learn from each other. So thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader.